right here with just a little quick statement from...
Pardon me.
It's a long one. A little statement from Sleepy J. Inslee.
I got probably the most transparent administration in our state's history, and I'm proud of that.
Great. Well, let's start with that as a baseline then, Governor. Hey, Jay. He's asleep again. Shh. Governor went back to sleep. I love it when it is. Jay! Woke him up. Jay, when a politician is all over an issue until it involves one of his supporters, why do they do that? Why do politicians do that when they're all over an issue? Oh, it's the most important thing in the world. But then when it affects one of their supporters, they say nothing.
It's based on ideology and politics rather than the facts on the ground.
Okay. So let's go with that as the second baseline. Now let's go to this story. 80,000 gallons of poop is in Sinclair Inlet. Now, A, don't clean it up because that's racism. Remember, county councilman had said if you spray the feces off the sidewalk, that's racism. He did. That's a true thing. But let's also remember this with King 5 News. They talked to the a Pacific something spokesperson. I don't know what that means, young Tom. A spokesperson, J.C. Matthews, talking about the effects of human waste in Puget Sound from King 5 News.
It's poop. It's.
See, everybody likes to say that now. All of a sudden, that's okay. And I guess I said it too.
It's poop. Right. It's you know, human waste going into the water. And we use the water in a lot of different ways. Scuba diving, swimming, shellfish harvesting, things like that. We need to protect these resources so people can safely use the waters. We have a lot of boats on the water, and the problem is boat waste is very concentrated, and if it's dumped all at once, it can really cause severe water quality problems that can actually make people sick.
Okay, so that was the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard spokesperson, J.C. Matthews, talking with King 5 News. 80,000 gallons of poop in Puget Sound. The environmentalists say about this, the kayaktivists have hit the water and they've gone out and they've said,
Oompa Loompa Doompity Dee. We can't say much. They give us money.
And our governor. Our governor, so concerned with the whales, so concerned with the orcas, that he put together a town hall where an 11-year-old got a standing ovation for saying, let us tear down all the dams. Governor Jay?
He saw some fights on the travel ban. He saw some fights on the health care. But he hasn't seen anything yet. Because we intend to stand loud and proud to protect the protections that we have now in clean air and clean water. And now we intend to fight back what we see coming, which is his efforts to degrade the environment of the West Coast.
That is a brain dead policy.
Yeah, so silence, Sleepy J, is what we're met with. Silence from Sleepy J. Inslee. Story number two. Chance to compare. This is why I was wanting you to be able to take this to your friends this weekend, your liberal friends, is just say to them, are you okay with the human feces in Puget Sound? Do you think that's good? Is the Sierra Club behind that? You're all good with that? If not, why is Governor Inslee not saying anything? Doesn't that harm the whales? Didn't he just tell us that Trump is killing the whales? Oh, that's right. It's a government agency. That's why Jay Inslee's not saying anything. Next up in this, we'll go back to the governor just to set a baseline. Remember when Governor Inslee's staff got him to wake up early in the mid-evening to go on to Bill Maher's show, and he couldn't wait to say this. Jay Inslee was so excited, sitting there in Los Angeles in the green room going, oh, my staff's giving me a, oh, what's it say again? My staff's giving me a great line. I'm forgetting it. My staff is giving me a great, oh, I'm forgetting it. And then he went on and he nailed it because he had that written on the side of his hand. If you looked at that clip on Bill Maher, I think Jay Inslee was reading this off the side of his hand, written there by a staff member.
You got the best weed in the United States.
Well, that weed, Jay Inslee, that weed from Seattle Times, Kristen Millars Young, Washington's penchant for getting high is trashing the place. Plastic doob tubes and small Mylar bags used to package pot are moldering in gutters and bleaching out in landfills and bobbing in waterways. Concentrated nutrients and fertilizers left over from cannabis growing operations are being dumped in public sewers and making their way past wastewater treatment plants into the Puget Sound. And millions of pounds of weed harvest waste that could be composted are instead getting trucked into the landfills. And producers of composting or composters asked about, hey, are the pot people coming down to get their stuff composted? Scott Dethridge, an operations manager for BarTech, a large industrial composter in Eastern Washington, said, and I quote, we haven't had any producers sign on. To be fair, Danielle Rolfson-Listen, I didn't do that right. Rolfson-Listen, president of the Cannabis Alliance, a nonprofit group of cannabis stakeholders, read lobbyists, dedicated to sustainability, says that she looked high and low for a bag that wasn't that was recyclable and got nothing. So she used the Mylar, I assume? So she used that. So let us again review. Clogging our streets, clogging Puget Sound is 80,000 gallons of poop that's out there. Jay Inslee said nothing about it. Now, clogging our streets, clogging Puget Sound is the byproduct of marijuana, and Sleepy Jay loves to talk about it on Bill Maher.
You get the best weed in the United States.
Loves to talk about turning things over to the kids.
Talking to dozens of these young people is we need to turn the world over to this generation as quickly as we can.
But when it comes to addressing environmental problems caused by governments.
We saw some fights.
Yeah.
But we intend to stand loud and proud to protect the protections that we have now in clean air and clean water.
Yeah, Jay, you're going to protect it all day long, ain't you just? Sometimes I need a mental cleanser. Do you? Linwood allowed a little boy to have a wish for the day. His name is Luca Keough. He's of Linwood, got sworn in to be the chief for the day on August 13th in Linwood.
You come to a lot of our events for us, so I think tonight it's important to swear you in as a new junior chief of police. Piece of cake.
Piece of cake, hey? Piece of cake, hey?
Piece of cake.
How are you?
Good.
Good. I'm Zach. Nice
hey,
to meet
Zach,
you.
Like my fancy shoes.
Whoa, those are new.
Yeah.
Whereas Luca loves all emergency services, has a personality that exudes joy and happiness. And whereas the Linwood Police Department...
Based on your strength and superhero personality, I hereby appoint you, Luca.
Thank
Keough.
You.
I'm not done yet. As the 2018 Wait. Chief for a Day for the Linwood Police Department. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The little boy is in his wheelchair and proud as ever. And thank you for giving us a palate cleanser where we can say someone did something good in government today. And listen, to the government workers, my dad was one. My mom was one. I know you're keeping your head down. We talk about the bosses. We don't talk about you. You guys are trying to get it done. We'll come back on the Todd Herman Show on AM 770 KTTH and on the Greater East Side, 94.5 FM. And I will roll into almost my fifth hour of live radio today. My brain's going to work just fine, right? We're going to talk Brennan a little bit. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about these. Are these really slips of the tongue? Chelsea Clinton saying we saved all this money from the economy by killing babies. Is that truly a slip of the tongue? and how to begin exacting more costs from the left when they do things like they're now doing to the baker in Colorado who was on Michael Medved's show today. Yes, they're still going after Miracle Bake Shop. We'll talk about all of that as we continue. Sometimes I marvel, I shouldn't marvel, but I choose to maintain a childlike mind, I guess, and hope against hope that maybe someone somewhere will stop with obvious histrionics. The thing with John Brennan, let's start here. Of course, the focus is on why the president said he did it. The media is saying, oh, it's the tweet. President said Brennan has said awful things about him. Well, Brennan has said awful things about him. So let's start there at the very beginning of the story. There was a time when intelligence chiefs did not make a living on the TV as professional criticizers of sitting presidents. There was a time. There was a time where you worked in government, you got your sweet, sweet, sweet pension. You went and sat on your sweet, sweet, sweet boards and you earned a lot more money. You did all that. Maybe you got a gig on TV as an expert on this or that that related to the to your area of specialty, such as intelligence investigations, and you were brought on and you commented in ways that were not Brennan-like. So let's start there. Let's also expand that into the histrionics. Brennan has not lost his gig. This makes his gig more important. So is it MSNBC who pays him to sit there and criticize Trump? This makes his stock go up because he's now, quote, been attacked. So he can shop himself now to CNN or other networks because, man, he's been attacked by Trump. That raises his stock. The other thing it does, though, is it involves this histrionics. And this is where I hope against hope, maybe the child in me thinking someone somewhere is not going to try to fool us into believing that John Brennan has lost anything related to his First Amendment rights. I fail to find that. Maybe you've found it. Maybe this is one of the things where you have to find the original Bill of Rights and take it out of the glass it's stored in the vacuum it's stored in Washington, D.C., vigorously lick it to reveal underneath where it says, plus, we all get access to classified information. So it's not a right. He's lost no such right. That is not true. What did Brennan do with his access? Well, the fact is, Brennan, and this is a great report, we had Sean M. Davis on from the Federalist. Sean is, man, is he smart. And he took us through the collusion between Brennan and Comey and CNN. Brennan to Comey. Brief Trump on the dossier. Why? Because then it will be news. Comey goes back to Brennan. Briefed. Brennan goes on the TV. Oh, CNN. Yeah, so it is CNN he's on. And says, hey, the president's been briefed on this. He tells CNN in private. Then CNN breaks the story. The president's been briefed on a dossier compiled that shows uncomfortably close ties between he and Russia. Brennan, who worked with Johnny Podesta, who was Obama's chief of staff. Brennan, who had to know Podesta, had sold his energy company basically to Vladimir Putin. Brennan, who knew Podesta, worked in the White House, knew that Obama was giving Crimea to Russia, knew Podesta was that compromised, did not leave his job and then get on CNN and criticize Obama over that. Brennan, who knew Hillary was taking a payoff in the form of a couple $100 million from Russia, or is it more than that? Is it $400 million? I always forget with the Clintons. At the same time as they were selling a good portion of our uranium in North America to Russia, Brennan did not go get a job at CNN and did not go and abuse his former position. He is doing that now. That's what he's doing now. So I don't care that he's lost his security clearance, his classified clearance. Why did he have it in the first place? When you leave, why don't we take it? So you don't have it anymore. Now, on another angle to all of this madness with Brennan, You are damaging the intelligence service too, John, because you're setting up a template. Leave your job. Go on the TV. Speak in histrionic, overblown, hyperbolic terms about the new president and watch the money come rolling in to mama with the sweet sound of the cha-ching and the ching-ching. Well, is that racist? Will someone check on that for me? Because I got a bad feeling about that one. Cha-ching. No, I think I'm okay. We come back on the Todd Herman Show. There is a form of anti-Christian discrimination you probably weren't aware of, but it involves this. Should a religious school be allowed to hire an intern from a college? I'm not kidding. And it's right here in Washington State. We have a representative with the Institute of Justice come on to explain a lawsuit in this arena in our very own state. Welcome back to the Todd Herman Show on AM 770 KTTH and on the Greater East Side, 94.5 FM. Christian schools, religious schools, should they be allowed to hire interns from local colleges? Apparently in Washington State, the belief amongst the left, I'd imagine, is no. Michael Bendis is with the Institute for Justice, joins us on the phone to talk about a lawsuit that's been filed around this. Michael Bendis, welcome to the Todd Herman Show.
Thanks for having me, Todd. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. I really appreciate what you guys do. It's a great blessing to have you in existence. So explain this circumstance to me that these religious schools find themselves in.
Sure. The case that we're talking about here concerns the Washington State Work Study Program. This is a college financial aid program by which the state pays a portion of students' wages in part-time jobs that are typically related to their major. The idea is to give the student real-world job experience while helping them to earn money for college and defray reliance on student loans. And you can work for pretty much any type of employer if you're a college student under this program. You can work for the government, so you can go work for the city of Seattle or Washington State. You can work for a nonprofit organization like the Boys and Girls Club. You can even work for a for-profit corporation, so you can go to work for Amazon or Weyerhaeuser or Costco. But the one type of employer you can't work for is any employer that the state deems to be sectarian. So, again, you can go work for a multinational corporation, but you can't feed the homeless at a church's soup kitchen or tutor a child at a religious school. That's perverse. Those are the types of activities you would hope the state would encourage, certainly not prohibit, but that's exactly what Washington's doing.
I am always curious about what portion of things like this are purposeful attacks on faith and an attempt to wedge us away from faith and an attempt to force us to practice our faith in our strange, tiny little buildings on Sunday morning versus living our faith. I'm always curious about what portion of it is that and what portion of it is protectionism. I guess that's a theory. I'm asking you to theorize, but what's your theory?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both going on. Certainly the justification that the state has for this exclusion are provisions in the state constitution that are typically referred to as Blaine Amendments. These are provisions found in 37 state constitutions, and they have a very sordid history that's steeped in 19th century anti-Catholic bigotry. I'm not suggesting that the state is, being specifically anti-Catholic in this instance, but it's relying on provisions that are certainly rooted in that type of anti-religious animus. So I think that that's part of it. But then, protectionism as well. You're onto something there because you also see these same amendments employed when opponents of school choice programs try to shut down school choice programs. you know, part of it, they say, is we can't have government funding religious schools. But another part of it is protecting the monopoly that the public schools have over the education system in our country. And so there's protectionism there as well.
And see, this is exactly this combination of things, is there's these excuses that people use to create legislation like this or barriers like this. And then there's the reality behind the scene. And of course, I guess those two things match up. We do have a governor who, and this is another perversity of law, I imagine you agree, that our governor gets to wake from naps occasionally and go and negotiate with his biggest donors. Behind the scene, he's negotiating with his biggest donors. They're negotiating with their biggest, their biggest benefactor, their biggest target for these donations. So he controls that process. So I imagine you agree with that sort of assessment of their powers.
Yeah. I'm not gonna, you know, I can't take a position on the governor specifically, or you know, political positions. We're we're ourselves a nonprofit, so I can't weigh into that. But I can certainly offer my opinions on what's animating the type of law at issue in this case. And it's absolutely, I think there's a little bit of anti-religious animus in there, and I think there's some protectionism in there as well.
So what are you guys, where's the lawsuit at? Who are you representing? And what are the damages? What does this actually cost these schools?
Well, so we, starting with your last question first, we are not seeking damages in this case.
No, no, I'm not saying you are. I'm wondering what the damages are to the school. I mean, they're at an economic disadvantage, are they not?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. The state, if you're allowed to participate in this program, the state will subsidize a portion of a student's pay. And so by being excluded from the program, there's certainly a financial impact for these would-be sectarian employers. But more importantly than that, you know, the folks that we represent, or one of the clients we represent in this case, Summit Christian Academy in Spokane, that was excluded from the program because it's religious, they want to be able to provide job training and opportunity for students whose conviction it is to go work for a school like Summit Christian. And that's a real concrete damage in itself, being targeted, singled out, and excluded from an otherwise available program simply because of religion. It's discrimination against the school. It's also discrimination against the students whose conviction it is to work for that type of school.
Yeah, it's fascinating the way, you know, protectionism and anti-religious sort of, I will say, bigotry, plays together hand in hand in this. So what are you asking in the lawsuit?
We are asking two things. We're asking for the court to declare this exclusion unconstitutional under the federal constitution, and we're asking the court to enjoin its enforcement, to prevent its enforcement in the future. We're not asking for monetary damages. We simply, and in fact, we don't in our cases ask for monetary damages. We seek to strike down unconstitutional laws, and that's exactly what this is. The federal constitution requires neutrality toward religion, not hostility. And here, Washington's being anything but neutral.
So imagine and I'm no attorney, and I think you know that. I mean, obviously, I'm a rodeo clown with a radio show. Michael Bendis is with us, by the way, with the Institute for Justice. I imagine some clever leftist attorney, me being political, not you, will come along and say, the you know, religious organizations, they don't pay taxes. So why should they participate in anything that provides the benefit of tax dollars? I imagine that's, and I guess I know my response, but I mean, I think that's a reasonable way that they, someone pro-government, pro-state would view this and say, well, they're not paying taxes.
Well, they could certainly make that argument, but it's belied by the facts of the case here, right? Because secular nonprofits are perfectly permitted to participate. So as the example I used before, the Boys and Girls Club, which is a secular nonprofit organization that as a nonprofit does not pay taxes, is allowed to participate. So this is not a profit versus nonprofit distinction. It's a religious versus non-religious distinction. And that's exactly the kind of line that government has no business drawing. The federal courts have made that repeatedly clear. Most recently, last year, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Trinity Lutheran versus Comer, held that government cannot discriminate based on religion in public benefit programs. And that's exactly what Washington's doing.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the pushback from people on the other side is really only they can only hide behind, I guess, these ancient, as you sort of described, sort of rooted in anti-Catholic beliefs. I guess they can only hide behind that because apparently they can't tell the truth. Well, our big labor sponsors, the big education lobby and big labor, they want us to do this. So I guess you have the advantage of having a truthful defense, whereas I guess they really can't come out and tell the truth, maybe.
They can try to spin, you know, what these state constitutional provisions are all about and what the history is behind them. But I think any credible historian will agree with us. But the fact of the matter is, even if the justification were something else, even if we weren't talking about these particular state constitutional provisions that they're relying on, the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear you cannot discriminate based on religion in public benefit programs. And that's exactly what Washington is doing. And the fact remains, no matter what the justification is, no student should be denied financial aid simply because of religion.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm so thankful for the Institute for Justice. And how can people help you financially?
Well, I'm not on to ask for donations, but they're more than free to visit our website. It's www.ij.org. We are a nonprofit public interest law firm funded entirely by private donations.
Yeah, but see, you're not here to ask for money, but I'm asking for it for you because no, listen, you guys are very important. I mean, it's taken years to get a level playing field. And, you know, the ACLU doesn't even pretend to be interested in civil rights anymore. And you guys are one of the few organizations that's actually defending civil rights in this way. So I mean it. So it's ij.org. Go check them out there. Michael Bendis, thanks for joining us on the Todd Herman Show. I hope you'll keep us up to date on the case.
I certainly will. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. We come back on the Todd Herman Show. Did I say this last hour? I'm sorry. Sometimes the brain, 6 hours of live radio, the brain starts to act like an empty vessel. I said we were going to do letters last hour, and it was just a few more things. So now, just so you don't get confused, no, it's not just a few more things this hour. That was last hour. Now we'll come back. And we'll get into your longer form communications, that is, like longer emails and social media posts. Todd Herman Show on AM 770 KTTH and on the Greater East Side, 94.5 FM. And thank you for everybody who wrote me a note about filling in for Rush today. It is obviously a huge honor. And I wanted to just give a special shout out to our engineering team in Seattle. We didn't get enough notice on this to have Bo Snerdly come out. The engineering team in Seattle just killed it today. It was flawless, and I just want to thank my colleagues on that. And frankly, also the management of Bonneville, who owns the radio station, for making those changes. It was stellar, and I want to thank my colleagues for that. Now, on to your emails, my favorite portion of the show, your longer, more well-expressed, but more voluminously expressed thoughts. You can always email me, therman@ktth.com. We do the text messages, we do the tweets throughout the show. This is where we get to your longer-form thoughts. There were a flurry of emails related to my hosting for Rush today, and I just wanted to touch on some of those. We talked about the latest scandal involving I guess it's a lot of priests. It's 300 priests and the abuse of 1,000 kids. We also balance that against the Rotherham scandal and how the media has played one versus the other, and about the media deciding that this is a Catholic Church scandal. The thing in Rotherham is just a scandal with some men who are vaguely of Asian descent. We also talked about the Chicago public schools. Incredible evidence of 243 kids having been sexually abused in one way or another by teachers, janitors, etc. In other words, media mis- bounds, but it is an absolute tragedy what has gone on in the church. We had a long discussion about how it could be addressed, talking to a lot of devout Catholics. John from Bristol, I assume Connecticut. Todd, I was listening to you filling in for Rush. In regard to the church scandal, I would suggest you research the Magdalen Laundries in Ireland, also the industrial schools. Both are a black stain on the Catholic Church in Ireland and the government of Ireland. A book on the subject called Suffer Little Children will shock and disgust you. I appreciate the note, John. Look, any form of child abuse disgusts me, and particularly sexual child abuse. Jim from Mazanola, Colorado. Hey, Todd, heard you on Rush today. Good job. My point is that we need balance. Any abuse is horrific. I applaud you for saying the Catholic Church alone isn't the problem, but too many callers just wanted to dump on the church. I don't want to get into a biblical or doctrinal treatise here. It would take hours. However, an extensive academic study was done by non-Christian researchers. Sorry, I don't have his name, but I can't find the podcast where I learned this. But his findings were that all of the venues he researched, the Catholic Church had the least amount of abuse. He looked at Protestant churches, government, public schools, the field of psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, healthcare professionals, etc. And they found they all had higher rates per person of trust than the church. Again, this does not dismiss evil anywhere. When you look at the case cited, this went on for 70 years. So when you extrapolate this over the time compared with the cited Chicago case and abuse in the public school system, the abuse by the evil priests is negligible. And as a former state employee in the psychiatric hospital, now retired, even the liberal philosophy here would not allow reporting sexual abuse or even a murder as it violated confidentiality. In that secular environment for decades, the belief that this was a treatable disorder, not a criminal issue. So being fair, you can't judge the church if the standards held by professional medics or medical personnel and public institutions were the same. Times have changed and professionals, teachers, etc. are required to report suspected abuse. Todd just wanted to give you a more balanced view than that expressed by others while you were filling in. Thanks, Jim. Jim, great note. Appreciate that. Yeah, I failed to mention, by the way, in the Chicago case, the teachers were required to turn in or to report notices of kids having been abused, and they didn't do that in, I think, 430 cases, I think. Now to the emails from a local show. Well, from my show. Yeah, right. Oh, like I have a national show. Oh, sorry. No, that was slip of the tongue. Slip of the tongue. I'm sure I'd want to be a national host. I'd much prefer chatting with you. Go to a Hall of Famer, since we spent some time with people who have heard me on Rush's show. Jay Payne, writing from 1789. Hey, Todd, of all the diseases running epidemic within today's American culture, is the one of mass innumeracy brought to you by your friendly big education cartel. This has sparked a curious media debate about the merits of socialism, which, when properly imposed, will bring about the golden end state of Progtopia. Capitalism is predicated on voluntary transactions, while socialism is dependent on authoritarianism. Contrast the near-miraculous invisible hand with Big Daddy's bludgeoning socioeconomic ham fist. Because capitalism is freedom-based, voluntary trades only take place when parties to a transaction benefit from it. If each party does not profit from a particular trade, they would nix the transaction. It wouldn't ever take place. Socialism is only required when one party profits at the other party's expense by use of force. When this phenomena is perpetrated by individuals, we call it committing a crime. When accomplished by Big Daddy and his agents, it is increasingly called social justice. Note that in order to engage in voluntary trade, which elevates the economic status of all the parties, it necessarily requires that each party produce a good or a service that satisfies the other parties in order to agree to the exchange of their product for yours. These freely traded resources or capital are not exclusive to money and widgets, but include one's intellectual and physical abilities, i.e. people's skills. But socialists reject the idea that one must produce or peacefully obtain their own capital in order to individually prosper. Socialism requires that the transfer of owners' capital against their will to those to whom it does not belong by using collective force. Note this transfer involves taxing and tax breaks, government credits, grants, entitlements, programs, legalized theft, along with a massive discrediting of the responsibility to produce your own resources. Note that a surefire way to stump a leftist regarding economics is to implore them to reveal the original source of wealth, that is, capital in society. They will unfailingly respond with a plethora of transfer schemes as sources of capital from the greedy to the victims, facilitated by armed, benevolent authoritarians, never realizing that all that wealth is forcibly transferred to them was originally produced and owned by someone else. The reason why socialism inevitably fails to bring about the prosperity to the masses, but rather yields the opposite effects, is because not only does it focus on vindictive transfer schemes rather than production of goods and individual responsibility to improve one's condition, but socialism is very effective at disincentivizing all parties to improve their individual positions, not pursuing the value of their own production. The fatal flaw of socialism, leading to mass impoverishment, is that the wealthy are heavily disincentivized to take risks to increase their productivity, because the more successful they are, the more Big Daddy and his agents will seize and vilify them, and worse, the so-called proletariat are likely disincentivized to increase their individual productivity, because they're convinced to wallow in victimhood, and the more successful they are in being disabled, the more they will be vindicated and rewarded by the socialist transfer schemes. Increasing valuable production is the key to wealth, ever lifting the average person's standard of living. Capitalism, predicated on free trade, backed by individual and property rights, always produces more wealth more fairly than any authoritarian system ever has or ever could. Well said, Jay Payne. One of the reasons you are in the email Hall of Fame for the Todd Herman Show. We'll come back on AM 770 KTTH, 94.5 FM. The Stranger says Seattle just ain't progressive enough. I'll explain it when we continue.